There are 89 species in Virginia that are protected by the landmark Endangered Species Act, a law passed by the United States Congress in 1972. In 2018, the law is under attack from many who say its scope is overreaching. Efforts to roll back the Endangered Species Act are being made at the judicial, executive, and legislative level. But first, what is the Endangered Species Act?
When a species becomes reduced in size, population, area of habitat, the federal government will, on its own initiative or by petition from others, consider whether to list it.
That's John Cannon, the director of the Environmental Land Use and Law Program at the University of Virginia School of Law. Cannon spoke on September 30th, 2018, at the Ivy Creek Natural Area as part of their Ivy Talk series. In this 70-minute podcast, Cannon explains the history of the act and how it technically works. He concludes by explaining some of the ways it is under threat. To introduce John, here's Chris Myers, a member of the Ivy Creek Foundation's Education Committee.
John's professional experience, I think, is a unique combination of having served in the private, public, and academic sectors. He began his career as a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and then moved to the Environmental Protection Agency in 1992. Where he was the Assistant Administrator for Administration and Resources Management. Did you ever learn to say that?
No.
And then became General Counsel in 1998. Washington's loss was Charlottesville's gain when John joined the faculty of the law school at University of Virginia. He teaches environmental and energy law, land use law, conservation planning and law, and serves as the director of the Environmental and Land Use Law Program. John's not only a noted author and speaker, but he serves on the board of directors of the Environmental Law Institute and the advisory board of the Policy Integrity Institute. He's passionate about the environment and has the ability to interpret laws and their implications and present them in a way that personalizes for them all. My pleasure to introduce our esteemed speaker, my friend John.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris, and thank you all for coming. So I wore my lawyer suit because I'm going to be talking about a law, and I'm going to impose some law on you, hopefully to give you a structure to think about endangered species issues. But I'm also going to try to localize it or regionalize it, so we're talking about, at least for portions of today, talking about species that are relevant to our experience here in the Charlottesville-Albemarle County area. So today, I've got sort of three parts to what I'd like to do today. First, to talk about the Endangered Species Act, how it's structured, how it works, some of its strengths, some of its weaknesses. Then talk about some local issues involving endangered species that are protected or have been protected under the Act. And then I'm going to spend the last part of the talk, and as much as you want to spend with me, discussing the future of the Endangered Species Act and also alternatives to it for protecting species and protecting biodiversity more generally. The Endangered Species Act is about protecting biodiversity to preserve genetic resources alive in the world, but it's not the only way to go about that, and maybe not the best way. And we have to think about that, and I'll invite you to do that with me. So, what the Endangered Species Act, what is it cover? It covers potentially everything that's alive, plants and animals, big charismatic animals like the grizzly bear, and little and maybe not so charismatic creatures like the Dully Sands flower-loving fly. The grizzly bear, you know, is an iconic species inhabiting Alaska and some portions of the lower 48 states. And it has been the subject of a listing and protections under the Endangered Species Act. And just recently, there was litigation that prohibited the a planned hunt of grizzly bears outside of Yellowstone National Park. A U.S. District Court judge said that that hunt could not go forward as planned by state officials, so the grizzly bear still retains some protections under the Endangered Species Act, although their populations in the lower 48 states have rebounded since they were listed some years ago. But the Endangered Species Act really, in terms of what animals and plants to protect, makes no distinction. The only exception is for insects that have been determined by the Secretary of Interior to have harmful effects that vastly outweigh any benefits that would be achieved by preventing the extinction of those species. So everything else is fair game, so to speak, under the Endangered Species Act. What happens under the Endangered Species Act is that when a species becomes reduced in size, population, area of habitat, the federal government will, on its own initiative or by petition from others, consider whether to list it. And listings either are in the category of endangered species or threatened species. But the important thing to remember as a general rule is that a species that's listed under the Endangered Species Act as either endangered or threatened is subject to the full protections provided under the Act. A species that's not listed, even though it may not be in the healthiest of conditions, is subject to no protections under the Act. So the Act has an on-off switch that is quite decisive. So for listed species, all the things I'm going to talk about. For not listed species, even those that may be beleaguered or close to being threatened, no protections at all. Think about whether that's a good idea, whether that's the right way to have an act. So how does a species get listed, or what are the criteria for listing a species? A species gets listed as endangered if it's in danger of extinction throughout all or a significant portion of its range. And a species gets listed as threatened if it's likely to become endangered. Pretty straightforward. Importantly, the listing decision is supposed to be made, the statute requires that it be made, solely on the basis of the best science and commercial data available. Science would be science relating to the needs of the species, the habitat remaining to the species, the threats to the species and their impact on the continued existence of the species. Why is commercial data potentially available? Because part of what the Endangered Species Act protects against is the adverse effects of traffic, of commerce in the species. So commercial information would be available. Cost, that is the cost to society of listing the species, is not, at least under the statute, to be considered. Right? Some consideration given to whether state and local programs exist that could potentially protect against the extinction of the species, that's to be taken into account. But costs, the cost to us, the cost to landowners, for example, of not being able to do things on their property with listed species that they would otherwise be able, those costs are not to be taken into account. And that's a big controversy, because in certain portions of the country where there are significant numbers of endangered species and folks make a living on the land by running cattle or engaging in other extractive or developmental processes, concern is that the listing of a species can severely limit the economic use of those lands. And some of those folks argue that cost should be taken into account in deciding whether to list. Okay, so a species gets listed as either endangered or threatened. Then what happens? The agencies, there are two agencies involved here, potentially Fish and Wildlife Service, which deals with land-based species, and the National Marine Fisheries Service, which deals with marine species. Well, I'll be talking almost all about land species, so I'm going to be talking mostly about the Fish and Wildlife Service as the key government agency involved. Upon listing, the Fish and Wildlife Service is supposed to, and in probably two-thirds of the cases actually does, put together a recovery plan. And what's the recovery plan? It's a plan to bring the species back to a level where it can be delisted, where it is no longer endangered or threatened. And the plan can include federal actions, it can include state actions, or even private landowner actions that might be anticipated to take place. Also, the Fish and Wildlife Service is to designate a critical habitat for the species. That habitat, which is thought to be essential for the survival and recovery, because the end goal here is always recovery when a species has been listed as endangered or threatened. The essential habitat necessary for the survival and recovery of the species. And that has certain legal implications that I'll talk about in a minute. Now, there is an out in the statute where it is or is determined not to be prudent. Prudent is the word for the Fish and Wildlife Service to designate critical habitat. And for years, the Fish and Wildlife Service used that as a kind of hedge, if you will, to avoid designating critical habitat in a lot of cases. More recently, the service has been called to account by federal courts, and it is more typically going through the process of designating critical habitat. Landowners resist being designated as critical habitat, because when that happens, they become subject, or activities on their lands become subject to limitations that may prevent certain economic uses from taking place. So critical habitat designation can be a quite controversial step in the process. And then there are certain legal protections under the law that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to use numbers. I hope this doesn't put you to sleep, but I'm going to talk about the take prohibition, Section 9. So when I say Section 9, I'm talking about the take prohibition. And then I'm going to talk about the no jeopardy provisions in Section 7. So those are the only two specific provisions I'll refer to, right? But they're important in understanding how the statute actually works and why I'm calling it, I mean, this is not my original characterization, other people have come up with this, why I'm calling it the pit bull of environmental statutes. Okay, so Virginia has, just as to bring it local just for a bit, we have 89 species that have been listed under the Endangered Species Act, including the Virginia Northern Flying Squirrel, which is, I understand, a reclusive. Some of you may know a lot more about these species than I do. A reclusive, nocturnal, gliding mammal that exists in certain relic populations in the mountainous areas of Virginia. Has anybody seen one of these? Oh, really? So what did it look like? Oh, but you saw it gliding, so it actually can do that. Amazing. Yes. What was your sighting?
Years ago, not far from here, we had one in our living room. and I both moved fast enough. I couldn't tell you what it
looked like. Wow, that's a close encounter of the endangered species kind. This is just an example, right? It's all the way from this reclusive mammal that sometimes gets into people's houses, I guess, but not often, probably, to the Atlantic sturgeon, which is an anadromous fish that lives at least part of its life in some Virginia rivers and reaches a size of, I think they're 100 or more pounds. Has anybody seen encountered an Atlantic sturgeon? Right. Well, they used to be very plentiful in waters in the mid-Atlantic, but they got fished hard early and their populations have further declined because of declines in water quality and other impacts on their habitat. So they are now endangered also. So the Endangered Species Act is relevant to us. And I'm going to show some more examples of that. The bald eagle, somebody said I should talk about the bald eagle. Why not? It's the iconic species for our country. It's the national symbol. And we were about to drive the national symbol to extinction. And through a series of measures, these preceded but included the Endangered Species Act, we managed gradually to bring the bald eagle back to at least viable levels. So it started as early as 1940. People understood that the populations of the eagle were declining. There was an initial effort to protect it called the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. It was listed in 1967 under a precursor of the Endangered Species Act. And then, and this was a crucial action, not triggered directly by the Endangered Species Act, but a response to the concern, to concerns about the extinction of the endangered of the eagle as well as other raptors. In 1972, EPA banned DDT, which was determined to be responsible for problems in the reproductive cycle of the eagles and other raptors high in the food chain. It was listed in 1973, a recovery plan was prepared, and numbers recovered by the year 2007 sufficiently for the eagle to be delisted. So the eagle is no longer an endangered species or a threatened species, but it is an example of what the Endangered Species Act, in combination with other statutes, like the federal pesticide statute, can do to bring back a species which was literally on the brink of being out of here. I think when the species was listed, there were, in 1973, there were 417 breeding pairs, down from 50,000 breeding pairs, people estimated, when the United States first designated the eagle as its national symbol. I think now there are about 10,000 breeding pairs. So the big rebound, huge rebound, by more than a factor of 20 during the period that these protections were in effect and began to take hold. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the law. Okay? So put on your law hats. What the Endangered Species Act sets a series of prohibitions for endangered and threatened plants and animals. And most of those prohibitions go, that things people can't do to or with these animals and plants that have been listed. And most of those prohibitions go to selling, you know, making, trading in interstate commerce and so forth, focused on the trading of these animals or parts of these animals as commercial products. And in some cases, including the eagle, some of the pressure on the species was as a result and is as a result of commercial use. Species are used for products that are then sold in commerce. So a lot of the Section 9 protections relate to that. But there is, in addition, for endangered animal species, a provision in Section 9 that prohibits the take of a listed animal species, specifically an endangered animal species, but the Fish and Wildlife Service can provide by rule that that take protection be extended to threatened species as well, and typically that's done. So what's a take of a listed animal species? If you were reading the statute and you didn't want to violate it and you saw the word take, what would you say would be prohibited by that? Yes?
Birds were killed by wind turbines.
Okay, so there's a killing. If you kill a species directly.
Accidentally by wind turbines?
Yeah, okay. Could be intentionally or accidentally, but you take the species by killing it. Okay? Good example, wind turbines. Anybody else have a, you know, does, just sort of whatever your gut tells you about what tape might mean?
Hunting,
yeah. You, when you hunt, you take. When you kill something, bring it home, put it on the table, that's a take, yeah.
Capturing. Zoos are for pets.
So capturing, yeah. You possess it, you take it.
Well, I was going to say that, but suppose you want to take one and start a breeding program to replenish stock.
Yeah, well.
Then
you, well, that would be illegal too, but you have to get an experimental permit for that. You can do that, but you have to get special permission. You're exactly right. That would be a take. You're taking something out of the wild, possessing it, reducing it to your possession and your control, and that's considered to be a take. Any other thoughts about what take might mean?
What about if you destroyed habitat that was meant to be like a rookery?
Okay. So what your comment raises the big question that was surrounding this idea of take for a long time and finally has been resolved. So the question is, does this word take apply to not only the physical taking, the direct physical taking, killing, trapping, bringing under possession of a species, but does it also extend to habitat destruction, where the habitat is essential for the viability of the species? And while this debate was going on, the Department of Interior proposed a regulation, adopted a regulation that take included the destruction of habitat, where the destruction of habitat affected life functions of the species. Reproduction, food, other life functions that were essential to the species' survival. That was controversial. The Supreme Court upheld it in a case called Sweet Home. So now it is established in the law that take includes the destruction of habitat. Why is that so important? Because most of these endangered and threatened species, particularly animal species, are endangered and threatened because habitat is being destroyed. Through development, through alterations relating to farming, mining, other activities. We are expanding. We, the human population, are expanding in ways that are diminishing the habitat for many of these species, and that's why, in many cases, in most cases, that's why they are threatened with extinction. So that was a big step. And now that we know that that's the definition of take, or that that's included in the definition of take, I can include that here. Habitat modification that actually kills or injures a listed species. Now, sometimes this connection is hard to make, that a modification actually, this is the words of the regulation, actually kills or injures a listed species. Because the effects are indirect, right? By definition, the effects are indirect. You cut down a tree that may be a nesting site for a species. Well, you have to show then, technically, under this definition, you have to show that cutting down that tree that might be used as a nesting site is going to injure a bird that might be able to nest there or would otherwise be nesting there. So it can be complicated, but important. And this is part of what makes the Endangered Species Act applicable. If you do that, you can go to jail for a year, up to a year. That's pretty sobering, isn't it? Every time you go out and clear brush, do you know what's down there? Cut down a tree, clear a field. This is not often implemented to impose criminal penalties only in the most egregious cases, but it's there as a caution to folks to say whatever you're doing, including activities that you would otherwise consider normal on land that you own, may run afoul of this anti-take provision of the Endangered Species Act. And that's what creates a lot of the resistance to the Endangered Species Act, particularly in areas where folks make a living, again, by working the land, being out on the land, changing the land, modifying the land, and the habitat that may exist on the land. Okay. You can take a species and not go to jail if you get an incidental take permit under the Act. And this is important for what we're going to talk about later, too. An incidental take permit is available only if the take is incidental. You can't get one for killing a species or trapping a species or bringing a species under possession. But you can get one for habitat modification, where the purpose of the modification is not to kill or injure the species, but to do something else. You know, whatever your ulterior purpose is. You want to clear a field or drain a pond or whatever. So the take has to be incidental to qualify for this permit. You have to show that you're not going to affect the survival and recovery of the species. That's elemental, right? And you have to show that you're minimizing and mitigating the take to the maximum extent practical. So you have to show how you're designing your activity in a way that would minimize the take and how you're offsetting the take through other, maybe you're destroying one area of habitat but improving another or providing for some mitigation on adjacent land or something like that. And if you make these showings, if you convince the Fish and Wildlife Service, then you can go ahead with your habitat changes subject to these conditions without being in violation of Section 9. All right. Section 7, the other big barrel. Let's think of the endangered species as a two-barreled shotgun, if they still make those, right? The first barrel is Section 9. The second barrel is Section 7. Section 9, this is important, applies to everyone, to the government, to individual landowners, to anyone who might be involved in activities that could be described as a take, including habitat modification. Section 7 only applies to government actions, to government officials who are taking actions in their role as officials of the federal government. And what it says is government officials cannot act in a way that is likely to jeopardize the continued existence of a listed species or adversely affect critical habitat of that species. How is that determined for a proposed government action? The Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Marine Fisheries Service prepares a biological opinion prior to the government action. There's some informal alternatives, but this is the basic mode. A biological opinion that says, yes, its action will jeopardize, or no, it won't jeopardize. Or it won't jeopardize with certain conditions that have to be followed. And that biological opinion will also include an incidental take authorization. Why? Because if the action won't jeopardize, but will result in the take of some species, those takes will be illegal under Section 9 unless there's an incidental take authorization that goes along with the biological opinion under Section 7. Okay. Is that making any sense? Okay? Everybody with me? The scope of this, it applies to government projects. So if the government wants to build a dam on the Rivanna River, you know, the Bureau of Reclamation wants to build a dam on the Rivanna River with government funds, with your tax monies, that's a federal action, and that would be subject to Section 7. They couldn't do it unless they could show that they wouldn't jeopardize a species in that project. But it also applies to government approvals, federal government approvals of permits. So the Atlantic pipeline that's coming across the mountains to bring natural gas from the fracked gas lands requires a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission permit to grant that permit, which is a federal action, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has to go through this process for the whole pipeline, even though the company, the entities carrying out that pipeline are private entities. What makes that a federal action, or what makes that subject to Section 7, is that it requires a federal permit. So the reach of this can be quite broad, right? All right, any questions? All right.
Applies to the military, too?
Applies to the military, too. There are some exceptions for national security concerns. Yeah, but the military goes through the Endangered Species Act process, generally. So the key case, and I don't want to belabor you with a lot of court cases, but this is probably the most important environmental law case ever decided by the Supreme Court, and it was decided under Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, and it gave teeth to the Endangered Species Act that enhanced its reputation as the pit bull of environmental statutes. And this is TVA v. Hill, right? The Tennessee Valley Authority versus Hill. Hill was a law student who decided he didn't want a dam to be constructed on a river that he cared about. And he and others brought litigation that ended up in the Supreme Court. And what was the subject of the litigation? Two subjects, I'll say. One, the snail darter, which you can see by comparison with the paperclip, a small species of no known economic value, not even a recreational, maybe it was good, as one of the Supreme Court justices said during the oral argument, is it good for bait? Well, it might be, but that would be about it. It was not a fish that people fished for or took home and ate, or put in their fish tanks, or anything else. And it was discovered, actually, while this dam, which was being constructed by the Tennessee Valley Authority, was under construction in the Little Tennessee River. The biologist went out, looked for stuff, whatever they looked for, and found this little fish and decided that it was its own species. And decided and found further that it was very limited in population and that its critical habitat, as was later confirmed by the Fish and Wildlife Service, was exactly in the portion of the Little Tennessee River that was going to be drowned when this reservoir was filled up. And because the little fish depended upon the fast-moving water and the clean gravel for its reproductive habitat, that dam was going to pose an adverse alteration of that critical habitat and therefore would be in violation of Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act, right? So here was the situation of the case as it came before the Supreme Court. The dam was virtually done. All it was required to do was to close the gates and let the water fill up the reservoir. Right? The fish had been listed. Critical habitat in the proposed reservoir site had been determined by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And the court was presented with the question of whether it should stop the dam, effectively preclude the closing of the dam, in favor of this little fish, or whether it should let the dam be completed. And the arguments were, I'll simplify them, but the arguments were basically, look, we've got $100 million in this project sunk. And we got this little fish of no known economic value. I mean, what's the issue, court? Why would we ever stop this dam from being constructed and finished and brought to completion as planned with all the benefits that are supposed to flow from this? Was not a significant hydroelectric dam, but the idea was that it would improve the regional economy, it would create recreational space, it would transform poor farms into high-end recreational properties and lakefront estates, right? Much to the benefit, at least that was the argument of the regional economy. Well, the court read the Endangered Species Act, and it determined that the dam could not go forward because of its impact on the fish. And it concluded, based on its reading of the Endangered Species Act, that Congress had intended that these federal projects not impair the viability of the species, no matter what the cost. That the Endangered Species Act, at least under Section 7, was a cost-blind statute. So whatever the cost, didn't matter. Which was quite stunning, you know, in, given the arguments that were presented to the court. So I would say this was a high point of the Endangered Species Act, at least in terms of the power that it was understood to have and its potential effect on the direction of public policy. Now, what happened after that? What do you think? Was the dam ever built? Do people know? What was your, what would be your guess? Was it built, notwithstanding that decision? It was built. Now, how was it built? Hmm? Well, it's about to be closed here, but what Congress, what the court says is you can't close that dam. But what happened is the Congress went back to the drawing board and overrode the court's decision, basically. How could it do that? Because the Endangered Species Act is a statute, and Congress can change the statute. And for this purpose, it changed the statute to allow the dam to go forward, notwithstanding any prohibition in the Endangered Species Act. It did also, this is an interesting thing, to me anyway, it did also provide, it added to the statute a provision called the God Squad, which allowed a group of cabinet-level officials to meet on questions arising under the Endangered Species Act, Section 7, and decide to override the prohibition where the benefits of the project far outweighed any cost to the species or any cost to the associated with extinction of the species. This case went to the God Squad before Congress chose to just override the Endangered Species Act. It went to the God Squad, and the God Squad determined, based on all the evidence before it, that even with all the $100 million that it was already sunk in the dam, it was not worth it to spend the next dollar on the dam in terms of the benefits against the cost of the fish. It was basically, in the estimate of the God Squad, an ill-advised project from the very beginning. But notwithstanding that, Congress came to the rescue, and you will go, if you go to the Little Tennessee River, you'll see the dam. It's up and running. Water's flowing, you know, over the spillway, and you will see the nice estates along the boundaries of probably what's called Tellico Lake, yeah. Well, that's an interesting story, too. They found other populations, right? So the snail darter is still alive. It's not flourishing here, but they found some other populations, yeah.
What year was it?
In the 1970s. I can't give you an exact date. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Any questions about that? So big deal. It makes the Endangered Species Act look very strong and effective. We had our own TVA V Hill here in Albemarle County. Did any of you live on Buck Mountain Creek? Yes? Where do you live on the creek or up the creek?
Up the creek.
Up the creek. You may live on land that would have been underwater had this project gone forward, but for the James River spiny mussel. So this is an endangered species of mussel which exists in remnant populations in Virginia, North Carolina, and West Virginia. It likes a certain set of water conditions, slow-moving but clear water. And it's endangered because that habitat has been altered through deforestation, agriculture, fertilizer, pesticides, and so forth. So the populations of these mussels are probably 10% of the area that was initially occupied. And this was the proposed Buck Mountain Reservoir. This is before we decided to go to the Ragged Mountain route, right? This was the alternative to the Ragged Mountain route at one point. And this is the Buck Mountain watershed going up. This is the Ravana, South Fork of the Ravana. The Buck Mountain Creek feeds into that. We live not far from this outside, but the idea was to dam. There's a beautiful gorge here, which is perfect for a dam. The idea was to dam that and then have a reservoir backing up from that that would supply all the water that Albemarle County and Charlottesville might need for the foreseeable future. What's that? So it was a great plan until the James River spiny mussel was discovered to exist in Buck Mountain Creek. And the result was, in an evaluation that was conducted in 2004, that the impact on the spiny mussel and the stream impacts meant that the dam should not go forward. So it was put aside. It was never litigated. But you know, in the back of the mind of the people who were making the assessment, the TVA Hill was very present, because it would have been a repeat of TVA V Hill. Okay. All right. Another local project, a regional project, is the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Any of you live in the path of the pipeline? Know people who do? Been out there, protested the pipeline. Yeah, I see some smiles there. So the pipeline comes over the mountain from West Virginia, the mountains from West Virginia, crosses several tracts of national forest, crosses the Skyline Drive. What's that?
I think it's Blue Ridge Parkway.
Blue Ridge Parkway, yeah, sorry. And then comes on down and splits up to serve the coastal areas of Virginia. So this is a long thing that crosses a lot of natural habitat as well as developed lands. And several of the areas that it crosses are federal. And to cross those areas, national forests, the Skyline Drive, right? Those crossings require the permission from federal officials, and therefore Section 7 is implemented here. And there was a biological opinion done on this whole pipeline by the Fish and Wildlife Service to determine whether the pipeline would cause jeopardy to any of the species that were located along the route. And because of such a long route, you could imagine there would be several species that might be implicated, and in fact there were. I've noted five here. There are actually six. I don't know why I left out the last one. I just ran out of space. Everything from the Roanoke log perch to another mussel, species of mussel, the club shell, to the Indiana bat, all of which are endangered. Or threatened, and all of which would be affected by the pipeline. The Fish and Wildlife Service, questions about it? Fish and Wildlife Service issued a biological opinion saying, okay, you can go forward, subject to some conditions, and it issued an incidental take permit, as we've discussed before, which is crucial to the compliance with Section 9, anti-take prohibition. And that went before a court. So here's an overview of the process, just to give you a sense of how this actually works. So the Atlantic Coast Pipeline is going to build the thing, whatever that company is or that set of investors. They're going to build this pipeline. They submit a permit to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has the authority at the federal level to approve or disapprove the pipeline as a pipeline in interstate commerce, carrying natural gas and interstate commerce. So FERC has to review it. FERC's main issue with the pipeline is whether there's a need for the pipeline to carry natural gas. It's really not in the business of endangered species protection. It's in the business of efficient and marketable energy supplies. But because of the Endangered Species Act, Section 7, FERC has to go to the Fish and Wildlife Service and get a Section 7 opinion that the pipeline isn't going to jeopardize any of these species. And that's what it did. And it got that opinion. And then that went to court. These cases often go to court because nobody is satisfied, or at least the opponents, in this case, the opponents of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline were not satisfied with the opinion that was issued by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And the court held that the incidental take limits in this Fish and Wildlife Service biological opinion were invalid. And that happened just recently. And it's the first big monkey wrench that's been thrown in the Atlantic Coast Pipeline approval process. The court said, yeah, you can issue an incidental take permit, but you have to be specific about the limits of any incidental takes. And it found that the Fish and Wildlife Service had not been specific, that it had issued only vague and unenforceable limits, and therefore the incidental take statement was invalid. And therefore, it had to go back to the drawing board. Now, that is not a death knell to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Why? Because the service can come up with another incidental take statement that will include the limits that the court said were absent from the one that it actually put out. But it's a delay. And, you know, sometimes things happen. Sometimes things change during delays. Okay. All right, so how are we doing? The pit bull fights for its life. This is my little pit bull, a lovely, loving, affectionate little pit bull. So what are the areas of attack, or what are the fronts of attack on the Endangered Species Act? Legislative, as we've seen in the case of the snail darter in TVA v. Hill, Congress could just change the damn law if it decided to, and it might, and I'll talk about that. The executive branch, the offices that work for the President of the United States implementing these laws, they have numerous regulations and interpretations of the Endangered Species Act that they could change to make it stronger or weaker in its implementation, right? And then you have the judiciary, which is constantly reviewing these cases, deciding what the statute means, and giving either more protective interpretations, as the court did in TVA v. Hill, or less protective interpretations, as we've seen in many other cases. Now, just to go through these. So there is a foot. The Endangered Species Act is always being threatened with amendment. There is no Congress that goes by that doesn't see some significant activity targeted on making the Endangered Species Act less, you know, from my perspective, effective, or from the perspective of landowners, more reasonable, right? And that goes on all the time. So far, they have generally not been successful. There have been targeted amendments allowing certain species not to be listed or otherwise, as in the case of TVA v. Hill, allowing one project to go forward. But the general reform of the Endangered Species Act has not occurred. But now it's being proposed. Senator Barrasso is pushing a new comprehensive reform of the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act amendments of 2018 want a bigger role for states. Right, states on the recovery teams in numbers equal to the federal officials. with powers to vote to roll back or change recovery plans, and also states to give feedback on Fish and Wildlife staff. So states get to say, we like this Fish and Wildlife Service official, but not this one. And regulatory incentives for landowners to get landowners to voluntarily step forward in return for a relaxation or limitation on their obligations. And then having voluntary landowner agreements considered in the listing decision. So listings might not take place if landowners had voluntarily agreed to take certain protective actions. Administrative, these are changes taking place within the executive office. I'm just going to tick them off, and we can talk about them when we have some time afterwards. Reduce protections for threatened species. That is, don't extend to threatened species the same protections that you extend to endangered species, particularly the anti-take provision, right? Facilitate delistings. Get animals and plants off the list faster. Think about costs when you're making a listing decision. Yes, the statute says that you can't consider costs, but that doesn't mean that you can't document the cost so that the public knows how much these listing decisions are costing. The administration seems to think that that's important and that might eventually lead to a change in public attitudes toward the Act. Right now, public opinion is very strongly in favor of the Act. And narrow the scope of the Section 9 takings provision. All of these are things that are under proposal, under consideration by the administration to limit the scope of the Endangered Species Act protections. And then finally, there's a court case. I love this frog. So there's a court case. This is before the Supreme Court as an example of what the judiciary can do. This is a case where the dusky gopher frog, an endangered species, was listed and critical habitat was determined, and the habitat included not only the small area where the dusky gopher frog still exists in Mississippi, but also some forest lands in Louisiana where at one point the dusky gopher frog did exist but no longer exists. Those forest lands happened to be owned by Weyerhaeuser, which was not happy at being included in the critical habitat designation because it thought that designation might limit its options for use of the land in the future. And so the question before the court is, can the government designate an area as critical habitat for an endangered species even if the species doesn't currently exist there, if it's necessary, essential for the recovery of the species. And the dusky gopher frog is an interesting, well, it spends most of its time underground, as I understand it. There are only about 100 adult frogs, so it's really on the brink of extinction. But it has a habit, this was noted in the court opinion below, in the Fifth Circuit, it said, The judges put in a footnote that says, the dusky gopher frog, when you pick it up, will pretend to be dead. But if you hold it for a while, it will open one eye and look at you. And if it sees you're still there, it'll close and pretend to be dead again. So it's got it's got some personality. It's not just that. So what about the future? Several possibilities. We can talk about those if you'd like when we go into a comment period, and that's it. So that's my presentation, but what I'd like to do is really engage you on what you think about the Act, what your concerns are about the Act, what you think could be done to strengthen the Act or make it more reasonable or effective. The Act has its limitations. As I say, it only protects species that get through the listing process and not other species. It doesn't protect habitats or ecosystems unless there happen to be endangered species in them, and only to the extent that it's necessary to protect those species. So it's not a broad ecosystem protection act, never has been. And the question is that what we need in a modern era? If not, what would an alternative look like? Or should we go in an entirely different direction? You know, put a, I don't know, a habitat destruction tax on development and let people pay and then buy habitat somewhere else. Bunch of possibilities. So, what do you think? You happy we have an Endangered Species Act? Is it good? Yeah? Okay, that's good. Could it be better?
Yes.
So what would you do to make it better? One thing, yes. Okay, so the cause of the extinctions is looked at, but only on a species-by-species basis. So it's just, you're right. So there's no comprehensive review that I'm aware of.
Well, we know that in the Chesapeake, you've got the runoff from all the fertilization and chemicals. You've got the pharmaceuticals that are going into the water supply. Nobody's looking at anything to neutralize any of those things. It's just like when the end result comes up, things start dying, that all of a sudden people start taking more of an interest in it.
So should we do that through the Endangered Species Act or through other things like the Clean Water Act or the Pesticides Act? Or
the Endangered Species Act, yeah. If we're part of the species, it's going to be endangered.
That's true. Should we put ourselves on the list? other thoughts about what's going on here? Yeah, Till. Well, that is certainly true, but the question is whether that's something the Endangered Species Act should handle or whether you should have a more general, because they're spending money for the legislature on a lot of issues, not just endangered species issues. So that's money in the process, that's torquing the process on Endangered Species Act, on clean water issues, on clean air issues, on consumer protection issues, you name it. The question is whether it would be wise to deal with that in a generic way or try to handle it.
It would have to be federal, though, because they've already bought up the Virginia legislature.
All right, well, other question about who's bought up the national legislature, too.
Yeah.
That has to be a federal law. Yeah.
What is your opinion about the chances that the review for the pipeline will have a significant impact on
I think the pipeline will probably go forward just as a matter of the political dynamics that Till's already mentioned. I think there's a lot of momentum behind it. There is already a lot of on-the-ground construction that's occurred. I think the Fish and Wildlife Service will correct the issues that the court identified. It would be nice if this were a case like TVA v. Hill where the court said you just can't go forward because at least under the understandings, the facts that were available at that time, this dam will destroy this fish. The courts haven't said that here. They've just said your incidental take permit is not sufficiently clear. Now, it could be the Fish and Wildlife Service goes back and says, we can't make it any clearer. But I think that's unlikely. They will find a way to articulate limits that will ultimately satisfy the court.
And the dam was built regardless of the fact that the court...
Yeah. Because of politics. Yeah, Ann?
In the Eagle situation, was DDT specifically called out, or was it a class of chemicals that could be then broadened in regard to the other?
Oh, yeah. So in response to your question, the FIFRA, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, otherwise known as FIFRA, was the source of the ban on DDT by EPA. That was in concert with the listing, but it wasn't a function of the Endangered Species Act. That was a separate authority implemented by EPA. EPA could use that authority more broadly to protect species, and you know, not just species in danger of extinction, but all species and habitats that are affected by pesticides. It does so to some extent, but it has a very loose cost-benefit analysis that it implements. Now, interestingly, with pesticides, this is an interesting issue, and it goes back to your point. So EPA registers pesticides if, on balance, their benefits exceed their harms. That's not the test under the Endangered Species Act, Section 7, as we've seen. The listing of a or the registration of a pesticide is a federal action subject to Section 7. So EPA, for each pesticide registration, has to go through the Section 7 process. Yeah, which is not pretty because it doesn't work. Fish and Wildlife Service throws out, we can't decide what this pesticide is going to do to these species. So EPA has just, at least in the past, blown by that. And all recently it's been taken to task in court, and the court said, look, you got a law, Section 7, you have to comply with. You're not complying with it. You can't register these pesticides until you do that. So there's this frantic effort by EPA and the Fish and Wildlife Service to come up with a process, and they haven't solved that problem yet. So you have a kind of a legal train wreck there with two different statutory standards, two different agency missions. Well, you would have a problem raising that retroactively, but pesticides have to be re-registered on a frequent basis, so you can catch it when the re-registration comes up. Yeah. I mean, if you want to spend your life litigating Endangered Species Act cases under the pesticide, you could do that. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes.
Is there the take in the term of condemnation that people then get remuneration when their property is...
Could be.
That would take away the sting.
Right. That's right.
Here's your $1 million because we're not going to have...
Right. Right. So right now, say I own property and the only economic use of that property is to farm soybeans. And it's determined that my farming soybeans is a take. And there's no way I can get an incidental take permit because I can't minimize or mitigate adequately, or my activity would endanger the species, the survival of the species. In that case, I would be adjudicated under the current takings doctrine as having my property taken by the federal government, and I would be constitutionally entitled to compensation. But those cases, so a lot of those cases have been brought, few have been successful, because the landowner really has to show that all the economic uses are prohibited. And typically that's not the case. Typically there's some economic use that the landowner can make, although less profitable than what might be available in the absence of the Endangered Species Act restrictions. Yes?
During the Clinton administration, I can think of three regional sort of habitat.
Yeah.
Program and also the sage grouse.
Yes, right.
As well as the roadless rule, the national forest.
Right, right.
What is your opinion about the effectiveness of those plans as either a supplement to the Endangered Species Act or something to sort of modify landowner concerns?
I think those were landmark efforts to try to integrate, to try to bring together different parties. And to create a consensus or near consensus regional plan for the management of the species. In that case, the spotted owl, for example, became a kind of a surrogate for the old growth forests, which were its habitat. So that was an effort that President Clinton was personally involved in. And with that effort, I think there was a successful resolution. I'm not sure whether that resolution has been sustained. It would be under constant pressure from people who were not satisfied with the outcome. But those were grand efforts to leverage the act to bring about some broad ecosystem protection. That's really what those plans were about. And sage grouse habitat, the same thing. But since the act doesn't by itself support that, it takes a lot of players and a lot of voluntary commitment to make that work. And I just don't know how they've held up over time.
It seems to be with climate change,
Yeah.
That kind of mechanism or that kind of plan would be.
Right. Okay. That's right. That plan is important, but it's also more difficult because now with climate change, the habitat of species is changing or can change. It moves geographically, so the historical habitat is not the habitat that the species now needs. And
you need regional connections.
You need connectivity, and you need space for them, for species to go, which makes recovery planning that much more difficult. Some species have been listed solely because of the effects of climate change, like the polar bear, right? But it's not clear what remedy is available under the Endangered Species. I mean, the Endangered Species Act can't solve global climate change. It doesn't have the mechanisms for it. So it can address the problem, but not cure. It really doesn't provide the cure for it. Yes?
I'd like to suggest that why in opposition to the EPA is a danger, but so also is unthoughtful support of it. And
right.
I thought of that when you mentioned this current court case. So should we save a piece of the ecological system where something used to be? It seems to me that's a useful discussion to have. You shouldn't just say, "No, we're
going to say." Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And for me, the question is not. The justification for saving it is not that it used to be habitat; it's that it could again be habitat and would be necessary for the recovery of the species in order to be used as habitat. That would be my analysis.
But there's no other way.
There's no, yeah, it can't, what's been determined is that the dusky gopher frog exists in a very limited space, and that limited space is not sufficient for its recovery to a viable population. So what the Forest Service did is say, well, where else could it go if we were to reach a viable population? And it located this area that happened to be on Weir Harris. But that's, you know, that itself is I don't know, there's scientists in the room who could be more clear about this. But that itself is a projection, it's a speculation as to what it would take for frogs to be reintroduced into that habitat and flourish there, I think. I'm looking at you, Diana. Yes?
Something like the California condor, which was completely taken out of the environment,
right,
and then captive bred, so the habitat, you want to save the habitat, even though there's actually none
in it
or free roaming, and so you need to protect that. Is that the law? Is that what happened? I mean, it happened pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, that would be the idea of critical habitat outside the known habitat of the species, in the case of the condor, which is zero, right?
Zero.
Yeah. I mean, some people say, look, don't get hung up on protecting the species in the wild. Just, I mean, this is why I put cryopreservation up there. Just preserve their genetic material. And then we'll have Jurassic Park at some point in the future. We'll get them all up and going, right? It would be cool, yeah.
There were some other issues there, and the snail darn are kind of, people use that as a ruse,
right,
in a way.
Yeah.
Oh, this little fish, who cares?
Yeah.
But there was some Native American,
yep,
Cherokee,
yep,
lands that,
yep,
were really critical. It was good farmland,
yep,
that was,
yep,
lost. And the value of that land, if you look at building houses and lakes and recreational, would far surpass. Was it eminent domain? But the value of the land.
They used eminent domain in that case.
Yeah. So the value of the farmland may never approach the value, so it's kind of subverted by this other use that is,
yeah,
contrary to what, yeah, the, you know, eminent domain took away some valuable
land. Yeah. Now, all of that, I mean, those are very good points. So the endangered species issue there surfaced as the key issue because it's the issue that turned out to have legal traction. But the opponents of this project were not primarily, or initially certainly, not focused on the snail darter. They were focused on the small farmers that were being displaced. They were focused on the beautiful trout habitat that was being destroyed. They were focused on an historic and cultural landscape sacred to the Indians that was being destroyed. So there were a lot of factors. And this is not, this is the same issue that was raised with the spotted owl. The Endangered Species Act can't, because it's so strong, when you get it and you can engage with it, it bulldozes everything out of the way. So when there's an issue there under the Endangered Species, people use that and, you know, try to get where they want to get, where other issues don't have the same level of legal traction. And that's exactly what happened in the Tellico Dam. But there were farmers who had been on the land for generations who were displaced by eminent domain. They weren't rich farmers. The land wasn't most valuable for farming, particularly if it had a nice lake there that could be used for, you know, resort development. That's really the story. It was economic development. That's what that dam was about. Thoughts? Yeah.
I know you put the biopreservation kind of tongue-in-cheek up there, but I'm curious, as cloning gets more and more advanced in science,
yeah.
Could that potentially throw a wrench into the whole extinction? Is it possible that someone could make the argument that we can't get to extinction because we'll always have the possibility?
Yeah. I just wonder, I don't know, you people, you young people, you know, you sort of live in a virtual reality anyway, and why should we be so insistent on the old habitats the way they used to be with the old assemblages of animals, if we can preserve all the parts and reconstitute them at will? Why wouldn't that be sufficient? Why wasn't the Endangered Species Act just enter into a kind of a test tube phase with reconstitutive technologies to follow? I don't even know what I'm saying, but, you know. I mean, I think you raise a good question. Whether the Endangered Species Act, the kind of urgency we feel, will be felt by the next generation. Oh, because of the diversity, yeah.
Well, that's why places like this are so important. You've got to get kids out to enjoy this stuff and see it firsthand.
No, there.
So we care about it going forward.
I mean, you know, I care about it because just to be honest, my affinity is, I care about species and biodiversity in some abstract, but my affinity, I think this is true of most people, is to the landscapes in which these creatures exist, and they're part of those landscapes, but they're not the whole of it. And they're a way to protect the landscapes, like the old-growth national forests, right? Or the mountain, you know, the mountain land coming through the national forests, where people thought they had a bucolic retreat, and now they got a pipeline in their backyard. They don't want that. And the Endangered Species Act is a way to try to resist that. But at the heart of it, it's a connection to place and their place in nature, which is a much broader concern and not so easily reduced to a laboratory experiment, if that's the right word. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions about what we can do to help? Those of us who have land but not enough land to qualify for any of these land growers. I have a place that has a beautiful view. I have a nice green subdivision permits that were granted to the people who owned it before I do. I don't ever want to subdivide it, and I'm sure that Alice won't either. But at the same time, I would like to know what, if there's anything that as a landowner I can do with this bowl. I have about, well, I don't know, 16 or 17 acres, but it's not enough. It has to be
I think I would just keep it. And trust your daughter to keep it too. She will. Just keep it and protect it. I mean, you know, in the that's something that all of this sort of legal stuff ignores. Each of us has some potential to contribute. I mean, we can give financially to groups that make this their business, but we have the ability, and there are, I know there are many people in this room that have significant tracts of land that they have either placed under protection or protect themselves just through their stewardship. That's a contribution. That's a significant contribution. And I think it's part of what makes Albemarle County so beautiful. I mean, we have nice zoning rules, but without widespread commitment among folks that own land in the county, I think we wouldn't have the landscape that we have. I mean, it's a gift. I hope it stays. Anyway, other questions? Good? All right. Thank you.